It's the Cellular Memory Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Bad Art Thieves, Goodbye Paul Kurtz, the results of the Italian earthquake trial, and cellular memory. Are you getting more than an organ transplant? Let's begin episode 186.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So, listeners may notice that we're going to sound a little different today than normal. We are back in the studio live, and we're kind of getting adjusted to the new sort of setup and getting back into the way of things. So you're not going to have our normal intro and extra sort of music and introduction and all that. But you're still going to get the same fine quality of conversation, information, and skepticism. So, Ethan.
Yes.
What the hell happened this week?
Well, actually, a lot happened this week, Don. You may have heard. One thing that came up was the Great Art Heist. Did you hear about this?
I saw a little bit of something about art thieves not being very good because they picked something that no one would really want in the first place.
Well, yes, but that's kind of exactly what happened. Oh. You see, there was this art heist. It occurred in the Netherlands. It is described as one of the worst disasters for the art world in the last 50 years, which is a little hyperbolic. But nevertheless, it turns out these art thieves may not have been the most astute collectors of art. I saw this article in The Guardian by Jonathan Jones, and I'll quote his interesting take on this. Any idea that a tasteful collector commissioned this theft is undermined by the inclusion of Meyer de Haan's self-portrait. No offense, but this comparatively minor Dutch artist does not really belong in the company of others whose works have been stolen. Imagine yourself in a black sweater, mask, and gloves, dangling from the ceiling by a wire, or, most banally, walking through the gallery with a sack. Would this really be among your seven to steal? It surely suggests either a local eccentric or a crass pick and mix. So the paintings that were stolen included Lucian Freud's Woman with Eyes Closed, Reading Girl in White and Yellow by Henri Matisse, Harlequin Head by Pablo Picasso, Girl in Front of an Open Window by Paul Gauguin Charing, and Crossing Bridge in London by Monet. So, I mean, pretty big masterworks, right? Included is this kind of ho-hum, not really well-known or appreciated painting.
I think that's a proper word there. I think appreciated. I think what we have here is we have an artistic thieving group that is so ahead of its time that it's like, hey, you know, this isn't worth much now, but it's going to be, and it's easy to steal. Or the other alternative, of course, is that the person who commissioned the theft knows art. The people who did the theft know theft. So they went in there and they said, oh, we got this, we got this. And there's supposed to be this one by, Picasso or Picasso? Picasso. It must be Picasso. And they just grabbed the wrong painting. I mean, you know, it was like they were there and say, shit, well, I like this one. Let's take it home while
I'm
here.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, you shouldn't send an art critic if you want to, say, rob a bank. So you probably shouldn't send a criminal to be an art critic.
Exactly. And actually, I would be a little worried about that because the thief, if he was an art critic and you gave him your list of 10 paintings you want, he might go, you know, I don't really think that Picasso is a good one. I'm going to give you this one because it's much, much better. And as an art critic, I know these sort of things.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, as skeptics, I mean, the question of objective valuation of art is always a question for us, I suppose. And, I mean, how does one, you know, successfully evaluate the true objective value of a piece of art? I mean, I suppose if it goes missing, its value goes up, would it not?
Yes, or if the artist in question dies. So there is the potential, if you are an artist, you are literally taking your life in your own hands. So there's a good reason for no one to become an artist. It's life-threatening. But I think another interesting question, you've kind of hit upon it there, is there's a huge debate in the philosophical community, especially in the whole area of aesthetic philosophy, as to what gives art value. there have been some empirical studies. In fact, there's something that the BBC science show Material World does where they sew you on to be a scientist. And they had someone check the galvanic response of viewers to particular paintings and then the accredited value of that painting and see if there was any kind of correlation. And damned if I can remember what the results was. But I do think that they did find that people had a reaction to paintings that were worth more money. But because this was sort of an amateur sort of scientific experiment, there were a lot of confounding factors. And just because you had a reaction didn't necessarily mean it was a positive reaction. It could have been almost a negative reaction. But a lot of people who are in the aesthetics of art literally believe in sort of the Plutonic, that there's something out there called art, and it's not scientifically investigatable, which is an interesting area. Maybe something we'll cover in a future show.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as Don mentioned, a lot has happened this past week. And unfortunately, we have a bit of sad news. Paul Kurtz, who some of you may know as one of the founders of the modern skeptical movement, passed away over the weekend. He was 86 years old. And Paul's an interesting character. Ooh, that was a funny sound. Paul was an interesting character. He was not only instrumental in helping to lead the free thought movement, he practically created it as well. So not only did Paul help found organizations like CFI and others, he was a renowned philosopher. He created a lot of the literature on secular humanism. He was an academic, and he wrote a lot about humanism in general. And he was really responsible for stripping out a lot of the supernatural elements that existed in humanism, of creating a truly secular body of work, a modern humanist approach to our 21st century. You know, he helped build the ethical and moral system which the free thought movement today relies on. He had an astounding impact on this. And one of the interesting quotes that I've heard over the last couple days regarding Kurtz was that he was a feared, the name Kurtz was a feared name amongst the religious apologists. When names like Dawkins and Hitchens were, no one knew who these guys were. Kurtz was the guy who, you know, William Lane Craig had nightmares about. Because he was the guy who was out there creating a philosophically sound and reasonable argument for why believing in God was not a good thing. I mean, this was one of the first people to do that.
Well, and again, Paul Kurtz, to me, sadly, is someone who I have heard of, but I don't really know in any substantial way. But there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the evolution of skepticism and all that. And there have been key figures who sort of made the movement move ahead, moved it forward. I think Paul Kurtz would be probably in about the same sort of generation as someone like Carl Sagan that took sort of the idea of sort of philosophical skepticism and provided a more rigorous definition or foundation upon which it can be done. And then going with those who come after it, said, well, okay, it's not just enough that I believe this, but I should go out and help people understand, you know, this is the tools you have, and this is how you can make your life, the whole world, better by applying these tools without being too preachy. I mean, one of the big complaints about the Hitchens and the Dawkins, although I'm on the board with them personally, but from the complaints you get, is that they are too aggressive. It's not so much that here's some tools and you can learn about the world. It's like, you're wrong. Whereas Paul Kurtz, and Ethan will correct me here if I'm wrong, it's like, this is the method. This is why this isn't true. But not in your face. Or was he in your face?
Well, it's funny because he was in your face for the context of the time. Like, I mean, if Dawkins and Hitchens are sort of the new atheists, I guess Kurtz would have been the new skeptic. You know? Kurtz was not afraid of saying, I don't believe in God. He didn't really go to the extreme of saying, you know, religion isn't necessarily bad or that. And saying it the same way that Dawkins or Hitchens would go after you for being religious, Kurtz was more of an academic in that respect. However, when it came to science and skepticism, he was right along James Randi and Carl Sagan and going directly at people and saying, no, if you believe in power bracelets or you think psychic surgery is a real thing, stop it. You're crazy. Stop it. In fact, Kurtz was personally responsible for founding several of the major organizations Most notably, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which was known as PSYCOP, and that is currently known as the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. Kurtz also founded the Council for Democratic and Secular Humanism, which is currently known as the Council for Secular Humanism, and of course, the Center for Inquiry, which is now known as the Center for Inquiry. Kurtz was also the founder of the free thought magazine Free Inquiry. He also founded Prometheus Books, which was a publishing company that was the main supplier of humanist and skeptic literature, really a long time before the internet, which is one of the reasons why I think Kurtz is not a well-known figure, is because he wasn't really a blogger or a podcaster, or he didn't really have an internet presence. He had a presence on literature. If anyone ever has written a dissertation on humanism, 90% of your resources are going to be Paul Kurtz. Like, that's just the way it is. And, I mean, so his impact is huge. I mean, the PSYCOP, obviously most of us know, Carl Sagan was involved in that, James Randi was involved in that, Isaac Asimov was involved in that, and PSYCOP expanded over the years, and a lot of the skeptical organizations that are around today owe their beginnings to PSYCOP and their ability to organize and start groups.
And again, just to bring it in, how there's sort of a relevance even to today is quite often the community, we're talking about how skepticism and all that is evolving, and the fact that, you know, people like him moved it from a passive sort of activity to something that is active and in your life and is, again, not quite in your face, but quite willing to say, hey, stop that, as you pointed out, hey, that's crazy talk. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, if you did that, you would be seen as some sort of, you're offending people. It'd be kind of like blasphemy, but in a very different context.
Yeah. I actually only got to meet Kurtz a handful of times. The first time was at a CFI conference in Toronto. I remember it quite well because there was this pseudo-anthropologist giving a talk about how the out-of-Africa theory of human migration was wrong, and was making this really extreme claim that human culture was about 10,000 years older than mainstream science would have us believe. And during the Q&A, Kurtz stood up and basically said, you know, how can you say that the out-of-Africa theory is wrong given all the evidence that the theory has? Only he said it more with a lot of, like, force, and there was kind of this element of, like, you idiot to it that I'm not quite implying. And it was pretty cool. And he was really friendly to me. Like, I introduced myself, and he said, you know, how happy he was that people from all over Canada were coming to this conference. And he said, you know, oh, you skeptical activists, you guys are doing a great job, and you're doing such an important thing for society. And he was just really, like, kind of the opposite of Dawkins, actually. Unfortunately, Kurtz, some of his great things are overshadowed by some of the unfortunate aspects that happened later in life. Kurtz left CFI under some bad situations. He was basically replaced by CFI's current leadership, not only because they thought he was doing a bad job, but they thought, well, we need a successor to carry on the action. And Kurtz didn't really take this very well. He resigned in protest, had some sort of very public disputes with CFI, including one at a conference I was at in Los Angeles where he gave sort of there was basically a public argument in front of a huge auditorium of people at the time between Ron Lindsay, the current CEO of CFI, and Kurtz. And meanwhile, on stage, there was a panel of experts like James Randi, Jennifer Michael Hecht, and others. And Randi just sort of walked off the stage and left the conference during this whole kerfuffle. It was kind of ugly. But I was actually pleased to see that they seemed to sort of bury the hatchet. At TAM the next year, I saw them talking cordially, and apparently they even shook hands. So it looked like Kurtz was able to bury the hatchet, and which is really nice because, you know, as sort of the founder of this organization, it was good that, you know, it didn't end on a bad note. And he's remembered fondly, I think, by everyone at CFI as well.
Well, and I think, again, this shows one of the important things about any real movement, but skepticism in particular, is there needs to be sort of a separation between the individual promoting an idea and the idea to which they're promoting it. I mean, Paul Kurtz is a human being. And at the time, I mean, he died, what, 86? Mm-hmm. Right? So when he had this separation, he was 84.
About
right?
That, yeah.
No offense to those of a more mature crowd who may be listening, But as you tend to get up there in your years, your thinking patterns tend to be a bit more rigid, less flexible, and that sort of thing. So I could understand how he would see this as sort of a personal attack, you know, if only for ageism,
yeah.
Right? And it shows that he, you know, he was a rounded human being. He had some flaws, he had some personality issues, but that shouldn't take away at all from the message that he's trying to derive, which, again, because of the reconciliation, seems to have been the most long-lasting legacy he's leaving behind.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we take a quick commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back. So there's been a lot of articles in the news recently about an Italian child, about some scientist, about an earthquake. And the results are in, and we'll save that for the end. I just want to do a quick recap for those people who aren't aware about this whole science on trial, essentially, in Italy. So there were six Italian scientists who were charged with manslaughter of over 300 people for failing to predict an earthquake that hit the Italian town of L'Aquila in 2009. Now, the scientists, along with a government official, were on a committee tasked with assessing the results of increased seismic activity in the area. This group had a press conference and assured the public that there were no dangers. However, within days of having this particular conference, there was a major earthquake that occurred, resulting, of course, in death and destruction. After the quake, many of the victims' relatives said that because of the reassurances offered, they did not take precautionary measures, like leaving town or sleeping outdoors or what have you. L'Aquila public prosecutor was arguing that although the committee members could not have predicted the earthquake, they translated their scientific uncertainty in an overly optimistic message. In one particular statement by the government official on the committee, it said, quote, "The scientific community tells me there is no danger because there is an ongoing discharge of energy. The situation looks favorable." On the other hand, of course, one of the accused scientists had stated, "If we were to alert the population every time, we would probably be indicted for unjustifiable alarm." The prosecutor in question said that, you know, quote, "Nobody wants to put signs in the docket. All we want was clear information on risks in order to make our choices. Sadly, many things in science doesn't allow for the sort of black and white results," which seems to be what they wanted. So this is the sort of background to it. Well, the trial has gone on. There's finally been a verdict. And Ethan, what happened?
Well, it turns out that although they may have tried not to put science on the docket, they kind of did. The six scientists in question were convicted of manslaughter, and they all face up to 6 years in prison, as well as they're barred from holding public office again. And also, they're being fined. What was the number?
11.7 million or 9 euros, 9 million euros.
Yeah. So, not good.
They were definitely not happy people in that room.
So, the prosecutors to the defendants gave this falsely reassuring statement before the quake. Well, the defense maintained that there was no way to predict the major earthquake. And it was a 6.3 magnitude, devastated the city, killed 309 people. And now, of course, you know, the lawyers for the defendants are going to appeal this sentence. They have to appeal. But at the same time, it's like, well, this is a really dangerous precedent because no scientist anywhere in the world can ever say, you know, X will not cause harm. Because certainty like that doesn't exist in the scientific world. Everything from vaccines to climate science to even mosquito researchers can't make claims that a vaccine may not or may have an adverse reaction in 1 out of 10 people, or that climate change may not cause a flood here, it may cause a drought here, or that this strain of malaria won't be carried by this group of mosquitoes. I mean, we can't have that level of certainty. All we can do is make strong predictions based on, you know, empirical evidence, right?
Well, and I would even go, the term strong predictions, again, it's a word we like to use, but science is all probability. And yeah, just like if you go to a casino and you say, well, I've got this great system and 90% of the time this is going to win, every time you go up to the board, you're going to lose. I mean, not necessarily, but I mean, there's a chance that you are going to lose. So in science, there is no 100% sure. So even if it's probable or possible, and confound that with the current level of scientific understanding of earthquakes, I mean, we know a lot more than we do, but only so much in how the mechanism of earthquakes actually kind of operate. But we still now know next to nothing about what leads up to that earthquake. So once it starts to rumble, we have a, you know, we can say, oh, look, there's it's shifting, and we can understand the energy distribution and that sort of thing. But the actual critical mechanism that does it, it's kind of like cancer, right? I mean, we know once you get cancer, we can look at these particular cells that have mutated. But we really don't quite know what technically causes the particular mutation. We know things make it more likely, but there is no sort of ever really a smoking gun with regards to that. And these scientists seem to have fallen into that trap. And what confounds the issue even more, and again, this is deals with another topic we've talked about a lot on the show, is the idea of communication of science. That on this panel, you had a political government official, and he's the one who said, I think, the most damning statement of all, and that was his interpretation of the scientific evidence put into politicalese to be given to a mass audience. And I mean, what can you do?
Yeah. Well, I think that if they're going to make the argument that they released, quote, confusing statements about the potential for harm, well, I don't see how that holds up under scrutiny, because you could just as easily blame the school system for not imparting a deeper understanding of how earthquakes work, you know? And the other thing, like you said, we use terms, well, I mean, we're not scientists, but scientists use terms like probability, but they're using it in a different context than what the average person thinks about it. Like, if the scientists found out there was a 9% chance of a major earthquake, which means there's a 91% chance of relative safety, given those odds, you think that, you know, oh, well, big deal, 9%, that's not going to happen. But 9 times out of 100 occurrences, there is going to be a disaster. And it's really hard to get that across in a way that doesn't make it sound like you're minimizing the 9%, but not ignoring the fact that 91% of the time, it's going to be safe. You know, it's like with vaccines, right? People, the anti-vaxxers use this rhetoric all the time that we're not against vaccines, we want safe vaccines. Well, vaccines are safe. Probability speaking, they're like 98% safe. Now, yes, you do get those unfortunate tragic incidences, but that doesn't invalidate the majority of the evidence that is pointing at this is going to be safe.
Well, and there's another confounding factor, which I haven't read in any of the new articles, but I did read in the original, sort of when this first case first came to light, was there was sort of, I don't want to call him a dissenting scientist, but what I might call more of a popular scientist, an Oprah Winfrey kind of personality, who had been sort of crying wolf many, many times. And one of the things that was on the mind, according to the government official, was that this guy was saying, oh, there's going to be an earthquake here, and there wasn't. Oh, there's going to be an earthquake here, and there wasn't. And there's this worry that if you say there's an imminent chance of a major earthquake here, you have panic, and panic in itself can cause a lot of at least disruption, if not damage or death, because people, you know, that kind of thing can happen. So they weren't not only trying to convey the science, which, as we've already sort of pointed out, can be very confusing for a layperson in a society, not Italian, I mean any society, that doesn't really prize scientific knowledge in its populace. But it was also in the grounds of a background of someone who was running around crying wolf.
Yeah, and that's basically the position that this case puts these scientists into, is they have to cry wolf at any potential sign of trouble, which could be all the time. I mean, there could be a landslide, like, tomorrow. You know, they have to make the best guess they have based on their available evidence. And sometimes they're going to be wrong. And sometimes it's not a question of them being wrong. It's a question of probability. It's, they're not wrong when they say there's a 9% chance of an earthquake, because 9% of the time, there's going to be an earthquake.
No, and this leads into to another aspect, too, is that if you sit there, like I say, so I've already dissed this one guy for crying wolf, but if all scientists were doing that, then the actual importance of their recommendation, I mean, if they're always sitting there saying, oh yes, there's going to be a real chance for a risk of an earthquake here, you better be prepared, and again, 90% out of 99 times out of 10, there isn't. When scientists do give the warning, they're just going to start to ignore it anyhow because they know it's probably going to be wrong. Yeah. You know, so you also, you're not only diminished by sort of putting scientists in this state of paranoia, but you also diminish their actual impact at warning people about particular things. Because kind of, we've talked about that a lot when it comes to things like food safety, you know, where if you have this particular additive in food, ooh, it makes all food dangerous. And you go, well, okay, there may be a small little case in a small instance where that's true, but by making a big thing of that, you're ignoring these other major issues like regulation and all that, which are much more effective at dealing with issues. And people just turn off all the messages altogether.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of the case, more than 5,000 scientists have signed an open letter to the Italian president in support of these six scientists. So one would hope that that collective weight will help sway the situation. I mean, obviously they're going to appeal. Hopefully they can go to a higher court and overrule this. I'm not terribly familiar with the Italian legal system or how likely that's going to be, but I hope that, you know, at some point a judge is going to come along who understands science a bit better than this one did.
Well, and there's actually a potential positive spin, and again, I won't profess to be an expert on Italian law either, but I do think now with the way the EU is set up, the European Union, is that this case can become precedent-setting, hopefully in a positive way, but risks are in a negative way, because it can get bumped up to the European Supreme Court, because there is a justice body, and I'm not sure whether this case can actually get up that channel, but if it does in theory, and being hopeful scientific skeptics, the science will eventually win out, this could actually set a positive precedent by squashing this kind of a case.
Well, I mean, it does sort of remind me of the Simon Singh situation, where he took his case to the EU Supreme Court of Human Rights or something, and actually won there, and that set a pretty good precedent. So we'll have to see how this develops, and we'll definitely keep our listeners informed on that. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back after this.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back. So, Ethan, I had an interesting discussion with a not very skeptical friend of mine. We were talking about organ transplants. I mean, this most people probably do over lunch. anyway, he started to talk about how some people have major personality change because of transplants, but not from what you would normally think, you know, as a major life event, but because there is something in the blood or the cells or something that remembers the old host. I told him, of course, why I thought it was a bunch of bunk, but he thought it would be a good topic for the show. Me and my slight arrogance, I replied, you know, that if we ever did a sort of serious segment about cellular memory, as it's called, we'd be laughed off the air because, I mean, why would we even think such a thing was plausible? So I then went to what I consider to be a reliable skeptic resource, Skeptic Dictionary, and without actually reading it myself, I kind of insisted that, you know, he read the part about cellular memory. And yes, I know I can be a bit of an ass at times, but he did read it. He then said, to my surprise, well, see, it says that it's possible, and there are a number of people, studies, theories, and that about the subject that sort of say, hey, it's true and it's plausible. I thought he misread the entry. So I checked it out, and well, for different reasons than you may think, it actually does seem to be somewhat worthy of a segment all unto itself. Now, before you laugh us off the air, it did not actually say that it was plausible or true. But the way it sort of presented the data was, how shall I say, sort of funny and dry-witted, something that would not have conveyed to a true believer what I think was meant as the message or the information in the article. So first, what did it actually say? And brace yourself, some of this I think is going to be funny for our more dyed-in-the-wool skeptics. But so from the Skeptic Dictionary, and part of this is going to be paraphrased, part of this will be actually quoting. It sort of starts off by saying, well, you know, the origins of cellular memory are based in the magical thinking of our ancestors. You know, that by eating the heart of some courageous enemy, you'll be given his strength. Some of Chinese or traditional medicine is based upon this sort of sympathetic magic idea. Let us not forget the famous or infamous cure for virility by eating the tiger penis or the rhino horn.
So it goes on these days, actually, endangering the rhino to the point of extinction.
Exactly. It's very sad that this magical thinking still goes on. In fact, actually, you know, the practice of cannibalism is based upon this theory. And yes, Catholics, transubstantiation is, if not real, cannibalism, metaphoric cannibalism, so you still are buying into this sort of thinking. Now, of course, it's they go on and they talk about, you know, it's a huge meme in popular culture. You know, you get the arm of a psycho killer and it becomes the basis for some horror movie. How many of us can't forget the time when Homer got his hair transplant and turned into a snake, right? So, I mean, it's prevalent in our culture in a non-sort of serious way. Of course, then they go on and they focus on one particular case that and sort of try to provide a rational explanation for it. The case is about Clara Sylvia, who had a heart-lung transplant, who after the transplant had cravings for beer. In her book, she explained her sudden cravings for beer on the notion that her donor, who was an 18-year-old male, died in a motorcycle accident. The implied implication is that young men like beer. She got his heart, now she likes beer because of something that transferred on there. Now, it was at this point when I was reading the skeptic entry, I was expecting to say, well, this is why it's sort of crazy. And then here are some practitioners and why their thoughts are incoherent. But it didn't. So right after that, it started talking about a Dr. Larry Doocy, one of the Oprah alumni, who says, you know, he didn't actually accept cellular memory explanation for Claire's sudden craving for beer. He thought it was most likely an explanation, quote, is that the consciousness of the donor had fundamentally united with the consciousness of the recipient, enabled the recipient to gain information from the donor. Perhaps, he mused, the organ recipient entered a realm of consciousness where information about the another person can be accessed through the universal mind. And the only debunking they had for that was, perhaps, but is there a simpler explanation? And I went, okay, so then we'll go on to the next one. James Van Pro, who again, most skeptics will know in one way or another as a crazy spiritualist. He's quoted as by saying, donated organs often come from young people who are killed in car or motorcycle accidents and die quickly. Because their spirit often feels they haven't completed their time on Earth, they sometimes attach themselves to another person. There they essentially make the donor want to complete what the spirit didn't get to do in the first place. Then they go on, the skeptic dictionary says, you know, James gets his information from the spirit world. Unfortunately, there's no way to validate his claim. And again, I'm going, no, there is a great reason to unvalidate this claim.
Well, my question is, like, so suppose I'm killed in a motorcycle accident. How do I decide which organ to latch on to? Because if I take my heart, my lung, my liver, my kidney, you know, do I go with the heart? Because that sounds more cool. But, you know, maybe the lung. Because, like, you know, maybe I want to try skydiving. You know, like, I don't want to give my heart to an old lady who's not going to go skydiving, right? So.
Yeah, well, but you see, the midichlorians that are in your bloodstream infest every cell. So again, it's kind of there's a little bit of you in everything.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if like I ever get together with the other me's and meet. Hey, have you done skydiving yet? No, not yet. We went to a sewing festival.
Well, what about blood donation too?
Yeah,
which I mean was mentioned in one of the pop culture references, but So then they go on and they talk about Paul Perlson. Perlsall, who is a PhD, a psychologist and author. Goes much further in his speculation that certain cravings are passed from donor to recipient in organ transplants. Purcell claims that the heart has a coded, subtle knowledge connecting us to everything and everyone around us. The heart is a sentient, thinking, feeling being, communicating organ. He claims donated cells remain energetic and non-locally connected to their donor. And, of course, the debunking for that particular claim is he knows this. How he knows this is anybody's guess, which I guess has so far been the best sort of debunking been in there. But, again, this explanation in itself, you know, well, first of all, I think it's been almost, 500 years, if not 1,000 years, since we thought the heart was an actual thinking, feeling thing and not just an organ to pump the blood around. And you know, I guess we're going to mention maybe this a little bit later, but we talked about before, you know, this has been all based upon beer craving. Well, is that your major fundamental motivating force? But we'll talk about that a little later. So they actually even had, and I weeped when I saw this, they had some comments about the beliefs of Sylvia Brown and L. Ron Hubbard. And sorry, folks, I just can't bring myself to mention them, but take note that they are mentioned in a non-critical way in the dictionary. Then they talk about Dr. Candace Pert, a professor of the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at Georgetown University, who believes, quote, the mind is just not in the brain, but also exists throughout the body. Dr. Pert is an expert in peptide pharmacology. Quote, the mind and the body communicate with each other through chemicals known as peptides. These are found in the brain as well as in the stomach and all major organs, and these memories can be accessed anywhere in the receptor network. For instance, a memory associated with food may be linked to the liver, and such can be transplanted to one person from one person to another. Of course, they're debunking on this because they do debunking. The evidence for these claims has yet to be produced. I mean, Dr. Pert doesn't explain why we don't seem to be affected by the memories from the animals we eat. Perhaps the peptides get destroyed. Now, that last part was a whole debunking of that. But by mentioning that last thing, why don't we get them from animals, seems to say, well, there's actually a point here that might be true. And here's a reason why our sort of flippant comments about it may not be true.
Well, isn't peptide a type of cake? I seem to recall there was a celluloid peptide cake with mint frosting somewhere.
Yes. Star Trek had a famous episode. But peptides are sort of a complex protein. And again, the fact that this is a person who is a professor, you know, Georgetown University, makes this all sound like supporting evidence. They even go on that Gary Schwartz, a doctor, claims that he has 70 cases where he believes transplant patients have inherited the traits of their donor. He believes this because of, quote, the stories are compelling and consistent. He also said that when the organ is placed in the recipient, the information and energy stored in the organ, whatever the hell that is passed on to the patient. The theory applies to any organ that has cells that are interconnected. They could be kidney, liver, or even muscle. And again, I think almost all our cells are in one definition or another interconnected. And if they're not, then they're the virus or bacteria that's trying to eat you. And even it could be said to be connected to you in some way.
If you weren't connected, wouldn't you just fall apart? Like, yeah. That doesn't make any sense.
Which I think was also an episode of Star Trek.
But, yeah, probably.
So again, their debunking of this is Schwartz calls his belief a theory, but it is not a theory in the sense that scientists use this term. It would be more accurate to call it an untestable speculative model.
Sorry.
Well,
you could call it bullcrap. Like.
Yeah. Now, they do actually come back and they kind of have some goodness at the end of it, where they talk about how collecting stories to validate a hypothesis is a risky business. Stories of transplant patients that don't seem to exhibit memories from their donors don't prove that it's not there, which, again, seems to imply that there is something there to be gotten.
That's proving a negative in the first place, which is impossible.
Yeah. But then they do go on to say that you can cherry pick any particular result.
Right.
And, you know, you have confirmation bias. They do make a small but point about how confirmation bias can explain why sometimes it seems like they have this connection. And the entry ends... Sorry, I'm just give me a moment. The entry ends with this line that I think is probably one of the worst skeptic lines I've ever heard in a, quote, reputable skeptic resource. And I love Skeptic Dictionary. I go to it quite often. But it says, the stories are intriguing and may lead to some serious scientific investigation at some time in the future. Okay, I give them credit. One of the things about being a scientist and all that is to be open to the possibility that there may be more around us than we understand, and that, A, you shouldn't rule out something without sort of having looked at it, and B, you should acknowledge that whatever you believe now may change in the future, which is, I think, kind of what they're going with this one line. But at the end of it, I couldn't really blame my friend for sitting there thinking, see, even your Skeptic Dictionary says that this is not a crazy idea, and it's not only quite possible, it's almost probable, because the total absence of sort of, you know, contradictory evidence. Now, there was one other thing that I did think was interesting, and I actually learned two bits from all this, is that in the comment section, they had someone who was I'm going to call real scientists compared to what we've already talked about, that apparently in bone marrow transplants, and please take this with a grain of salt, I didn't have time to confirm this, but I can understand the mechanism that work. In bone marrow transplants, which are quite different than solid organ transplants, it is possible apparently to affect your immune system, and you can actually pick up things like an allergy, certain kinds of allergies, by doing that. But that's because your bone marrow is your immune system, and it's kind of like if you transplanted the lungs of a smoker into someone who wasn't a smoker, and the person who got the new lungs, or, which were damaged lungs, had trouble breathing. Well, you'd expect that, because it is something that is plausible within the context of that.
Yeah.
I also learned, again, just doing a quick thing, that there is something called cellular memory, and this is where you can get kind of confused, because they've done a lot of research more recently in things called slime molds and that, where slime molds can kind of learn things and they can kind of remember things, but these are not learning and remembering in the sense that we think about them. It's more, what was it? I was listening to the... CBC Quirks and Quarks, and they were talking about how a slime mold can predict the best optimized plan for searching for food, and one of the ways it does that is it remembers where it's been, and you go, but it's a single-celled organism, it doesn't have nerves, so I mean, how can it remember? Well, the cell must have some form of memory, literally, and how that particular works is that when it moves over an area, it leaves a bit of slime behind. and it has a reaction that whenever it says, oh, there's this slime, stay away from the slime. It's a very simple mechanism, but it has this really complex sort of results.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that to me is, it's not so much memory, but it's more of an evolutionary advantage. Like, I don't think if we could go inside the, quote, head of the slime mold, it's not like, oh, slime, I was here before. It's probably like evolution has favored the slime mold that doesn't like to touch its own slime. Has the, secondary effect of making it find better places to eat.
And that's where I got down with this. Because, I mean, ultimately, and I apologize to my friend if he's listening, cellular memory in the context that we were talking about is bullcrap. There's no evidence. It is, I'm going to be a little bit more bold here, impossible to exist in the way that it has been presented. As in, there is no even a theoretical mechanism for it to work. But that being said, I just, in a knee-jerk reaction, which we shouldn't do, just said, oh, there's this source, trust it no matter what it said, mm-hmm. which I shouldn't have done. I should have checked it out at least peripherally beforehand. And two, I think part of the problem is I'm not quite sure, and maybe Ethan, you can, because you know Skeptic Dictionary to a degree as well, I'm not quite sure whether this was meant for the layperson or the believer, or whether it was meant as a resource for skeptics, so that you would have an understanding of the crazy, so that when you talk to people, you understood what they thought, and then me, as a good skeptic, would go out and I could provide my own counter-arguments to it, and they didn't need to do that.
Yeah. See, that's the thing with Skeptic Dictionary. I like it a lot as well, but sometimes when you look up a pseudoscientific claim, it just summarizes the claim. And so, if you look up, you know, for example, like this one, cellular memory, it'll summarize all the different people who think this is a real thing. And it won't really go into any detail about why what they're saying is wrong. It's just sort of like, here's what they think. Which is useful in research, for research, because you can go, okay, so James Van Praagh thinks that, now I know where to start my research. But it's not really good for someone who wants to learn about this. You know, the way Wikipedia is sort of set up, if you look up, you know, the War of 1812, it explains the War of 1812. It doesn't just say, these are the people who believe the War of 1812 happened, you know?
Right.
And I mean, like you said, you can go through this article and debunk it pretty simply. I mean, most of these people are proposing an explanation that can't be verified or tested in any way, and the mechanism to create the effect can't be tested or verified. It might as well be magic. So right then and there, you're kind of going, well, okay, you know, if we can't test it, we can't see it, experience it, what's the difference from saying that it doesn't even exist in the first place?
And that goes in with the whole idea of the bubble, which you get much more in politics, but, I mean, you can get this in skepticism, and in-group versus out-group. Because, I mean, as you heard, I mean, we went through this all, we laughed at parts. There was the debunking they did in it, I mean, the one line or so, I mean, was more a joke. I mean, it was more like, ha, that's stupid. But, you know, it wasn't debunking. And in that sort of sense, and again, my first reaction said, wow, maybe I am in a bit of a bubble. And I don't realize that people who don't believe what I believe, or who don't have the scientific method, who don't know the resources I have, for them, what seems to me a completely silly and stupid argument isn't, because they don't have this connection. They don't live in the bubble. They live in a different kind of bubble.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that this sort of does, for someone who doesn't know the background of science, this is a very good example of a Gish Gallop of, like, oh, look at all these impressive names who have PhDs and who study at prestigious universities. They all think this, ergo, it must be true. You know, I mean, there's very few, for example, evolutionary biologists who will say, well, listen, evolution is true because of Richard Dawkins and Charles Darwin and James, you know, all these other people. That's not really an argument to base anything on, right? And when they're saying things like, you know, Swartz calls his belief a, quote, theory, but it's not a theory in the sense that scientists use the term. Well, they don't explain the term theory in science. I mean, that's a really important point, and they don't expand on that.
Well, and actually, there wasn't even a hyperlink. I was expecting a hyperlink or something, right? Because, I mean, you could say, well, we don't have the time, but you know, and of course, and this is where I think you, I do this, I think, on occasion, is that I think, ooh, this sounds really impressive, so I'm going to use this term. An untestable speculative model. Now, okay, I kind of know enough about science to understand what they mean by untestable, speculative, and model. But someone looks at that and says, oh, those are big words, right? And so I guess they're just saying that it's a model. It somehow describes the world. And they don't quite grab the idea that untestable and speculative are much more negative connotations in science than they would be as in, well, we're not really sure. This is a possible idea for an answer, which is what I think a common sense view would say. Well, we're not sure yet, but yeah. it's not so negative as it would be in a scientific context.
Well, I mean, it's a good way sort of to bookend the show because we were talking about the perils of communicating science with regards to the Italian scientists who were convicted of manslaughter. And this is another good example where terminology that we're familiar with, that we understand and take for granted, is not terribly easy to understand for a layperson. I mean, I can't even count how many times I've had an argument with somebody about some pseudoscientific thing, and I'll say a jargony skeptic term, and they'll look at me like I'm crazy. And it's really easy to fall into that trap. So we have to be really good at explaining ourselves, and explaining ourselves in a way that the public, who has no background on what we're talking about, understands what we mean. And when you say a speculative, untested model, what that really means is it's not testable, it might as well be false, and it hasn't been proven in any real way.
Well, speculative in this context is a guess.
Yeah.
Right? An untestable guess.
Yeah.
So
I mean, like, it's akin to saying, you know, every 5 seconds the universe doubles in size.
Does it?
Well, it could. It's totally unspeculable.
Yes, and perhaps to lead us to something that, because again, we're kind of still talking in the bubble, but quite often people will sit there and they will hear about quantum and how that term has been so misused in the universe as a whole. I'll say the universe because it's probably misused somewhere else. You know, people will say, well, quantum, I hear in the news that quantum connect two particles across a great distance. And this guy says, well, that means that my brain and your brain are somehow connected across a great distance. And that's the level of a lot of people's knowledge and understanding because we live in a complex society and all that. And we often will forget that we are a bit of nerds when it comes to a lot of this particular information, and that there is, in a certain degree, a second level of onus to make sure that when we try and convey our skepticism, we do it with an understanding of the person we're talking to doesn't have the same word set or knowledge set that we do. And again, when I started this discussion with him, I thought I was just being normal. But when I started writing down this segment, I went, well, you know, from his perspective, I'm an ass.
Yeah. I've actually, believe it or not, people have told me that I can be kind of annoying sometimes.
I find that totally believable. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, sure you do. Well, why don't we take a final commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with our skeptical highlights next.
CITR is proud to sponsor the 17th Amnesty International Film Festival, taking place November 2nd through the 4th at Pacific Cinematheque Theater in downtown Vancouver. The festival will show 9 films from around the world, which will highlight a variety of human rights matters and will include guest speakers, the presence of other community groups, and ways for the public to take action on said matters. So come join in on one of the biggest human rights film festivals in the country. For more information or to buy tickets, you can check out www.amnesty.ca/VFF.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we are running out of time here on the show. Let's go to our skeptical highlights. Don, you want to start us off?
Why not? So I've got two, one a bit more well worked out than the other ones, but one is a philosopher's cafe, something that I think is a great thing to have because we have far too little philosophical conversations in our world. Although this one, to be fair, is a bit more political than usual. Me going to politics, how unusual is that? Does electoral politics promote imagination, thought, and engagement, or has it become a tool to legitimize the rule by an authority of the few? wow, these guys really need to learn to have shorter titles for their talks. Essentially, it's a discussion about Citizens United's decision in the U.S. Supreme Court that has arguably made the vote a commodity, something bonds sold. Essentially, they said that $1 equals money is equivalent to free speech, and that electoral politics has become a marketplace for the exclusive trading of that commodity instead of sort of a forum where ideas, reflections, and imagination can be exchanged. So essentially, it's the idea that because of these sort of trends, politics has gone from a area of ideas and thoughts to just a commodity like going to the store and buying milk. And so this is happening Monday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Cafe Amicia. That's Commercial Drive in Kitchener in Vancouver. It is free. I also have another one that I'm going to throw up there because for people who know me, you may be surprised at how radical I turned out to be. But there's something called politicalcompass.org. If you go to this website, I came in as American because they only have Europe and America's things, but they ask you a series of questions, and they kind of have the left-right authoritarian, libertarian sort of agenda, and where do you fit on that spectrum, right? So you've got Stalin on the far left. Hitler, ironically enough, is more moderate, but both of them very authoritarian. Margaret Thatcher, which I thought was hilarious, was very relatively very authoritarian, not a Hitler, but close to it, but also very, very right-wing. And then there's Gandhi and all that. And yours truly turned out to be very, 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 very low leftist colony. So very sort of libertarian and very, very lefty, which, I mean, must shock our listeners. But it's a cool thing to go check out. I've got a few people who responded with their own results. And that's politicalcompass.org. So that's mine. Ethan, do you have any
skeptical highlights? I do have skeptical highlights. So the first couple that I'll mention here, actually, it turns out that one of the worst atheists, as we have named him, Sam Harris, is going to be speaking in Vancouver on the 29th. He's doing two talks now. The first one is for the Bon Mont Book Club. Tickets are a whopping $500 each.
Ow.
Through various organizations like CFI, the BC Humanists, and others, there is an option to get two tickets for $500. Still really expensive. Now, if you're looking for a bit more of a price-friendly opportunity to see Sam Harris, he's doing a talk at UBC on the same day, I guess earlier in the afternoon. You have to register ahead of time to go, and I actually haven't heard back when I attempted to register if I can go or not, so it's probably some kind of maybe draw or lottery. Nevertheless, we'll have links to both of those things on our show notes. Now, for our other skeptical highlights, we have a CFI talk that's coming up on the 26th called The Psychology of Good and Evil with Dr. Rajiv Jagani. Of course, that's Friday the 26th, 7 p.m. at UBC. This talk is free. There is a suggested donation of $2 to $10, so check that out. The other skeptical highlight involving me, over the weekend, I participated in a Google Plus Hangout with some of the bloggers from Skeptic North. And we discussed some of the recent pseudoscientific craziness that's going on in Canada. So you can check that out on Skeptic North, and we'll also have a link to it on our blog. It was lots of fun and pretty cool.
We should do that sometime.
We should do a Google Hangout sometime. Yes. So those are our skeptical highlights, and that's Radio Free Thinker.
Well, you know, I guess we're about the end of our show. I one thing I was going to mention, because Sam Harris is such a divisive sort of figure on there, right? I was surprised that when, you know, that was kind of going around the skeptic community that I interface with, that most of the talk was about the money that it's going with that. And to be fair, I mean, to a certain degree, this is how he makes his living. And I don't have a big issue with Sam Harris having a talk about that. But I was surprised that, I mean, maybe you got a different thing, but no one talked about, you know, the Islamophobia that he actively promotes and that sort of thing. And I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of dichotomy. People were more worried about the money and less about the message. It was going back to her talking about sometimes the person can overshadow some of the things they have to say.
Well, yeah. And the funny thing is, like, that's not extraordinary cost-wise. I mean, most of the speakers in our movement do charge a lot of money for their talks. the thing that I think people are maybe don't realize is that they tend to give significant discounts to skeptical organizations like, you know, CFI or whatever. And I mean, we mentioned that, you know, Harris was sort of one of the worst atheists. I don't think he's beyond hope for redemption, you know. I mean, maybe he can be turned back to the light side at some point. Perhaps a good way of doing that would be go to his talks and asking him point blank, why are you such a freaking bigot?
Yes, exactly. That sounds like a good thing to do. And on that note, I guess I'm going to sign off by saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.